from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
I think there's mounting evidence that they were complicit in one way or another, that they knew about it. Russians at some level knew about it, and they should be held accountable.
I think part of the reason you're seeing bipartisan support for this is that it does at least two things. Number one, it takes away a lot of machinery of death from a very, very bad guy. And, you know, there's a lot of people who will be alive 6 months from now that wouldn't have otherwise had this not happened.
I don't believe this is ultimately the end. You're right. We do have troops inside Syria. That means this might not be the final act when it comes to airstrikes against the Syrian regime. And if that's the case, I don't trust the ability of the Trump administration to be able to thread this needle.
Those are some voices from Connecticut's U.S. senators reacting and congressional delegation reacting to President Trump's missile attack in Syria. It's where we'll start The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable this week. I'm joined, as always, by Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Dankosky.
And Christine Stewart is here. She's editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello, Christine.
Hello, John.
And Dan Haar is here. He covers commerce, economics, wealth, and poverty for the Hartford Current. Hello, Dan.
Good morning, John.
Okay, so let's actually start here in the news this week, not just of the strikes against the Assad regime. We'll get into a little bit of what our delegation has said about it. We have Rex Tillerson meeting with his counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, of Russia. Russia already threatening a bit. The Trump administration, don't strike Syria again. We have this question that I think Chris Murphy puts very well in the soundbite, Colin, of a Trump administration having to thread a needle of trying to figure out how to combat an Assad regime, which has clearly done some of the most heinous things that people can do to other people. And we have video proof of it, which is something that no American president wants to look at and not do something about. You have Russian entanglement in this, with Assad being propped up in many ways by Vladimir Putin. And you have the stated goal of the Trump administration of wanting to defeat ISIS in the region. ISIS, of course, battling the Assad regime as well. So is the Trump administration able to thread this needle before we get to some of the other questions here?
Right. And so I don't know if I'm jumping the gun here, but I mean, this is one of the reasons Sean Spicer got into trouble yesterday by claiming that even Hitler didn't use gas on his own people. And then he started talking about Holocaust centers. And the reason he got into trouble was he's trying to articulate something that maybe cannot be articulated, which is what is the explanation for this foreign policy swerve? I mean, the Trump administration has not been very consistent about any foreign policy dating back to the campaign. But if they have been consistent, if you could read them pretty carefully, they have been sort of consistent about, you know, prior to the missile launch, the idea that Assad was essentially an internal problem to be solved by the Syrian people, that they didn't really see this as America's job. And then overnight, it changed into something else. So why did it change into something else? Well, he's killed hundreds of thousands of his own people. Many of those people were babies. Babies seem to be very important in this conversation, but it's important to understand babies, you know, have died in very horrible ways prior to the gas attack. So what's going on here? And it almost looks as though the lesson that you would learn is, whatever you do, if you're a ruthless strongman, try not to do it in such a way that it will generate pictorial evidence that Donald Trump and his family will see, because that seems to have been sort of the trigger here. I mean, the other thing I would just quickly say about this is, yeah, so it doesn't seem to exist in the context of policy. You could probably work out an articulation of policy basically saying, well, this is kind of the first use of chemical weapons since the 2013 ban on them, so maybe that is what did it. But they haven't really said that exactly. Maybe they said it yesterday. But and a lot of this is going to be a staffing problem. I know I'm a broken record about this, but they have a broken staff process there. You ordinarily have all these people, deputy people on down at state and defense, who look at all this stuff, analyze this stuff before you launch the missiles. They're the ones going, okay, what's the worst that could happen? Like, what, you know, what's the possible downside of doing something like this? What's the reason we are doing something like this? And one of the reasons they don't have a lot of answers is that the people who provide that answer, those answers have never been placed in the administration. There's hundreds and hundreds of key jobs going begging right now.
Well, and something, though, that I heard some analysis on NPR about, which I think has some validity, is there's always been a sense from observers of Russia that Vladimir Putin respects strength from wherever. And Donald Trump has said, I will be a strong leader. Barack Obama was a weak leader. He allowed Bashar Assad to cross a line. He set a line in the sand and then allowed him to cross it. And so if nothing else, I'm going to prove that we are strong, which will gain some sort of traction with not only the Russians, but others in the region.
Yeah, but strength isn't something that you can establish in one day. I mean, look, it's very possible that this was the appropriate response, kind of in the way that a blind pig finds a truffle once in a while. And the question is, can a matrix of foreign policy be erected around it? Do we have a different foreign policy towards Assad now than we did a week ago? Rex Tillerson was very clear a week ago saying, it's not our job to take out this guy. You know, that is not America's purpose. Do we have a new foreign policy, and who's going to explain it? To me, that's the question. Because, yeah, you can launch 59 missiles on one day. That doesn't necessarily make you a strong man, and it isn't even necessarily ultimately desirable that you consistently become a strong man.
Well, and then we also have Nikki Haley at the United Nations saying that there needs to be regime change in Syria, which is the opposite of what Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is saying. So you're right. I think that the administration does have to come up with a position, which I don't think it has yet.
But what about the reaction of the Connecticut delegation, others in Congress who are saying, well, look, maybe we accept, as Colin said, that this might have been an appropriate action against this despotic ruler who's gassing his own people and crossing a line that nobody should cross. That said, you should really talk to Congress about it first. It's an act of war.
Right, exactly. I mean, the Connecticut delegation is kind of united on this front. I went to John Larson's public forum on Sunday at the University of Hartford on the topic of Syria, and he said, you know, look, the president does have the right, if our national interests are at stake, to make a preemptive strike against a foreign nation like he did. But then he needs to come to Congress, which really hasn't happened since the Vietnam War, and ask for their permission.
Well, there's also a distinction between asking for permission as a formal act of war status and just simply informing the appropriate committee heads and other leadership in Congress, which doesn't seem to have been the case here. But I think the broader pattern is this president and this administration is simply operating in chaos. And this president does not have a history of sincerity. He is on probation in respect to saying things that are in any sort of consistent connection between how he feels and what he does and what policy is. And so I think to look at this one incident, missile incident, is wrong. It has to be looked in the broader context, and that's why I'm not a conspiracy theorist. But this does look very, very, very much, especially since it was an ineffective action. The next day, Assad was taking planes off of right out of that same airstrip.
Ahead and warn the Russians, which they did.
Oh, they did.
Presumably the Russians will tell the
Syrians. So, but my point is that it has to be viewed in that sort of broader context as a Lewinsky bombing, and I see no reason not to say that. Clearly.
This poor girl, does she have to bear that? I mean, does this have to?
Yes. Yes,
she suffered enough.
Okay, so Dan's perspective is exactly the perspective that all of John Larson's constituents, for the most part, had on Sunday night. You know, that they felt that this action needed to be taken in the greater context of who Trump is and what he has said in the past, and they didn't feel that their congressional delegation was going in that direction.
I will say that in general, that that whole argument that you've got to go to Congress, blah blah blah, I don't think that one has a lot of traction for exactly the reason Christine said, which is nobody ever does it. And I think the American people don't even. I mean, look, if you want a protracted war, presumably you should go to Congress. But in terms of these missile strikes, I'm not even sure the American public wants the president to have to do that. I think the American public kind of likes the idea that the president can occasionally do stuff like this. I mean, then you go case by case, and whether it's the Clintons or Bush or the Obamas, you can look at missile strikes that maybe you particularly didn't like or thought were political in nature or were possibly motivated by the Lewinsky scandal and raise questions about them. But I'm not sure you can get a lot of political traction saying, oh, to do this one thing, he should have talked to us first.
Well, look, and one of the things that we're talking about here is the way in which the administration talks about what it means to do what its policy actually is. You hear maybe Nikki Haley saying one thing, Rex Tillerson saying another thing, President Trump saying another thing. So who might clear something like this up? Well, maybe at a press briefing you'd have Sean Spicer come out and explain what the administration's policy is. But with all these questions on here, as often happens with the administration, questions that we have are temporarily put aside because of something like this.
I think when you come to sarin gas, there was no, he was not using the gas on his own people the same way that Assad is doing. I mean, there was clearly, I understand your point. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. There was not in the, in the, he brought him into the, to the Holocaust Center. I understand that. But I'm saying in the way that Assad used them, where he went into towns, dropped them down to innocent into the middle of towns, it was brought to it. So the use of it, and I appreciate the clarification there. That was not the intent.
That's Press Secretary Sean Spicer yesterday. The he's referring to is Adolf Hitler. Yes, somehow during Passover, he's decided to compare Assad to Hitler, saying that he didn't gas his own people and coined the term that we just heard there, Holocaust Center. I think one thing we've learned a long time ago, Colin, is if you're going to start any sentence with Hitler, ... you probably should just think about it before you say it. Like, well, Hitler had some good ideas, but, or Hitler made the trains run on time, but, and it just, it sounds as though that's the sort of thing that any press secretary needs to know before you even start. You just never bring Hitler into the conversation, ever.
Right, and, you know, he did everything but end this sentence, and by the way, happy Passover. This was unbelievable, but also believable in the sense that just as there is a very chaotic set of foreign policy feints at Assad, you know, Assad is sort of okay. He might help us against ISIS. Now, no, Assad is, you know, Assad is the Syrians' problem. No, now Assad's our problem. You know, I don't think the, I think even as something as basic as the Holocaust, we know that the Trump administration doesn't have a clear policy. They left Jews out of a Holocaust statement earlier in their reign. Obviously, they've got Ivanka and Jared and the grandkids. But on the other hand, they have Steve Bannon, who appears to occasionally engage in anti-Semitic kinds of statements. And then they have Sebastian Gorka, who's about as close to being an actual Nazi as you can be in 2017, and he's actually part of the administration. So maybe it's not Sean Spicer's fault. Maybe one of the many things they don't have clarity on are Nazis and the Holocaust.
Well, and it's maybe not entirely clear how much longer Steve Bannon is going to be part of the administration, which is another thing that we're hearing. I don't know, Danny. We heard then Spicer go on. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking a little bit about when somebody makes a terrible, terrible PR mistake and then doesn't apologize right away. Sean Spicer, much to his credit, goes on Wolf Blitzer a little bit later and says it was a mistake to do that. He actually apologizes for this unbelievable gaffe that he made.
So what you're saying is that he's okay because he didn't drag someone off a plane? I'm trying in my head to defend it. And the best I can come up with is that what he meant at some murky corner of his brain is to draw a distinction between raining down chemical weapons in an area where you don't know exactly who's there and bringing people to death camps. His word was what?
Yeah. I'm sorry.
And killing them.
The more we try,
he's drawing a distinction between that. And I've tried really hard these last few minutes in my head, and I did last night as well, to justify that as an acceptable distinction. And I can't quite do it, but I want to. I want to give him credit because the reason is I don't want to go after Sean Spicer for a misstatement when the real problem going on here is an entire underlying policy of that's ridden by chaos.
And that's really what Colin was saying, Christine, is again, if there's no policy, trying to get up and explain it is probably going to walk you into some really dark corridors.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think he kind of realized it when it was happening, but then instead of stopping himself, he just kept digging. He did send out a statement 40 minutes after the press conference to explain. He said, "I was trying to draw a distinction of the tactic of using airplanes to drop chemical weapons on population centers. Any attack on innocent people is reprehensible and inexcusable." So that was his explanation 40 minutes after the statement.
So we're defending Sean Spicer, which there you go. I think that that's a little step forward for us. As we continue on in the program, we're going to take a break, and we're going to move on with Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, Dan Haar from the Hartford Courant, Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show. We're going to talk a lot about what's going on at the state level, including the Wall Street Journal, not surprisingly, saying Connecticut is a big mess, wondering what's going to happen if we have to raise taxes, which we almost certainly will have to do to dig out of our budget hole. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Dan Haar of the Hartford Courant, Christine Stewart of CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe, who's got a program right here on WNPR. And what's on your show today, Colin?
Today, one of our fabulous interns is helping us with a program about walls, about the efficacy of walls, whether walls actually work or not. It's easy to say build a wall. What do walls actually do? We're going to look at that across a whole set of historical and situational perspectives.
Excellent. We're talking about walls this afternoon with the Colin McEnroe Show at 1 o'clock. We're going to talk a little bit about state policy and politics. The Wall Street Journal over the weekend slammed the state once again for losing General Electric and paying hedge funds to stay, even though Boston paid more per job than Connecticut has ever paid for anything other than Jackson Laboratories. Dan Haar, I know that this is something that you've been following very closely. We've been hearing for years that Connecticut is in trouble. We talk about that on this program all the time. We have a budget hole that we need to fill. Christine Stewart, who covers the Capitol every day, is going to tell us a little bit more in a moment about where we are with taxes. But when the Wall Street Journal says Connecticut's just a mess, of what's going on in Connecticut, are they overstating the problem?
I don't think they're overstating the problem, but I think they're sort of in a way ganging up on the state in a way that's impossible. You're creating an impossible way to respond. For example, they said that Connecticut, I don't think they used the word desperately, but essentially by spending $55 million to keep two hedge funds in the state, they derided that roundly and said, while losing GE, without mentioning that Boston spent $185 million for 200 jobs, an amount per job that was only exceeded here by Jackson Lab, and that was a special case. So you're not making that point. And secondly, when they said, when they derided in the lead of the editorial, they deride Connecticut for desperately trying to keep millennials. All that is a proposal in Connecticut that's being discussed. New York State is doing it now. Exactly that. It's called the Excelsior Program. And I don't know. And so it's this selective, beating up on Connecticut. And I understand that the problems here are intractable. It would be better if the Wall Street Journal would actually come up with a suggestion as to something Connecticut might do.
Yeah, I think that would actually probably be a good idea. I mean, do you see it the same way, Christine?
I'm sure that lawmakers would love to hear whatever that suggestion is, because I feel like they're really struggling. We're at the point where we're hearing about these tax proposals, but lawmakers at the same time are worried about, you know, Connecticut is one of only four states that has continued to lose population since 2013. So can you increase taxes at a time to help fill a budget hole without making more residents flee the state? You know, and they're actually going to states. I mean, even if you talk to Kevin Sullivan, who's able to see where these residents are going, they're going to other high tax states except for Florida. Well, you know, so that's the outlier exception. But they're going to Massachusetts. They're going to New York. They're going to California. So is it really the tax policy that's driving them out?
Colin?
I'm not sure any of us disagree with the thrust of a lot of what's in that editorial, although I think our reactions do have to do a little bit also with the idea that as a Red Sox fan, I can criticize my team, but I don't like it if you criticize my team. And so many of the things that are in that editorial are things that we've said, and you know, that effectively bribing companies on a case-by-case basis is not as effective as what I consider to be the Dankosky policy, which is create a state that works, that has a viable infrastructure, that has good transportation, which millennials seem to like a lot, you know, that has interesting business districts in cities and stuff like that. And then people will stay. I mean, ultimately, I think what we do know about General Electric, correct me if you disagree, Dan, is that, you know, a lot of the reason that they moved to Boston was they just wanted to be in a place like that. You know, and it wasn't like they took those jobs from Fairfield and moved all of them to Boston anyway, but they wanted to be in a place like Boston that had, for reasons that had less to do with tax policy and more to do with everything else that's kind of interconnected there in Boston.
Well, and I think, but to your earlier point, Dan, and I'd love to hear your take on this, is if it was just, we want to go to Boston because it's a more interesting place where we'll have more people from MIT bumping into our CEO, and it'll be exactly the sorts of urban hub that great ideas are going to come from, with $0 attached, that'd be great. But on top of it, Massachusetts bribed them to come. And that's a part of it as well. When the Wall Street Journal says, don't bribe companies to stay, but how could you possibly lose GE? What are they expecting Connecticut to do to keep GE? Probably give them a whole truckload of money.
Well, what it's about is growth. What the Wall Street Journal is saying without saying it is that Connecticut is an economy that's not growing, because in an area that has a high tax rate, you can get away with that by growing. Because, for example, GE went to Boston for the exact reason Colin said, into a city that has an effective property tax rate that's about, it depends on how you value buildings, but per square foot property tax rate, that's at least 1.5 times Hartford, which mm-hmm. is the highest in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And when you're a low tax state, you can get away with that because you can have, you have people coming in and you don't have to raise taxes. So any way you slice it, the problem is that Connecticut isn't growing. And so that's why everything has to be focused on what can we do to get people in and keep people in? And that's why there's such pressure against raising any taxes here. And I don't think they didn't really articulate it that clearly.
Well, what about this idea of keeping young people in the state by getting them to stay here, giving them tuition-free school, but saying you got to stick around for a while? This is what New York's trying.
At some point, are we baby boomers going to be allowed to actually get money from our kids, or no? We just keep giving them. So, you'll wait, Christine. You'll see. So I thought that was interesting.
So
that
bitter.
I actually think that those are good policies, you know, and they lead to the old joke about, you know, I personally am going to go knock on the governor's mansion, and I get that it's called the executive residence. Thank you. And I'm going to go knock on the door of the governor's mansion and say, you know, Governor Malloy, it's nice to see you. I'm just out walking my dog, and I'm wondering if you'll give me $6,000 because I'm considering moving to South Carolina. And that's the end of this. But at the point where you're keeping millennials, if that's what you need, then go ahead and keep them and pay for them. $1,200 tax credit per year to keep somebody who's a college graduate with debt professional, and that's what the proposal is, $20,000 or more in debt for $1,200 a year in tax credit, is actually a good economic deal.
Are there people at the state capitol talking, before we get to the tax end of it, about how we're going to solve the budget hole and whether or not more taxes in the state drive people out of the state, Christine, are people actively talking about taking this proactive approach and thinking about something in a way that New York is right now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Democrats have this proposal out there to, I think it's a $1,000, whatever, is it $1,200, the $1,000 tax credit to give to millennials who stay here after college. But, you know, I just don't see that they're going to be able to afford to do that at a time when the entire budget, 30% of the budget is fixed cost. And so the discretionary part of their spending is, you know, they're going to decimate some of these human service agencies, and it's not going to be pretty.
When we debate priorities and how government should spend money, I think most of us agree, at least on principle, that we're opposed to corporate welfare. Well, what's corporate welfare? Well, it's all these grants and loans and tax incentives, this incredible thicket of ways that government essentially delivers money to private businesses. You know, and so some of the things that we've talked about here and that are talked about in the Wall Street Journal article are effectively corporate welfare. I mean, the most hilarious example from the last couple of weeks was a pita company, Moon Pita, which was getting money from the Small Business Express program here in the state of Connecticut, and it eventually was discovered that there were no pitas. There was no real company. It existed only on paper. Nobody was making any pita bread at all. But, you know, now we're talking about generational welfare in a way, right? We're just going to give money to people for no reason other than kind of how old they are, you know? And I just – how can that be good public policy? It just doesn't seem – I actually do think, you know, all joking aside, John, that you articulated a long time ago how to create a state where people want to live and keep their businesses. Make it a really good state. Stop singling out this company and that company, you know, for various kinds of largesse. Build the kind of state where people want to do business and want to live and want to, you know, have their lives and be entertained and be able to move around without being stuck in traffic jams. That's how you do it. And this notion now that for $1,200 some kid's going to go, oh, no, I guess I'm not moving to Austin.
Well, it's also predictability, too. I mean, you know, as a business owner myself, you know, Connecticut's tax code is pretty unpredictable, and it's pretty difficult to figure out every year. Yeah. I filed my extension the other day, by the way.
You know, we're already doing this. We're debating something that we might do that we're actually already doing. We're paying in the past 4 or 5 years, 6 years, $60 million to build state-subsidized apartments in downtown Hartford at an average of $56,000 per apartment unit on the construction side, whether it's new construction or renovation, in order to have and keep young professionals and Suzanne Hopgood downtown. And Suzanne is more energetic than any of them. So that essentially is the same policy. That's welfare for what largely is a targeted audience of young people working at Travelers and Prudential and Aetna and so forth.
I want to get to a couple quick phone calls on this topic because I want to talk about the tax side of this as well. But let's go to Peter in Stanford. Hey, Peter.
Well, I just thought of something. It's like, why blog in Austin when you can blog in Derby, you know? And we have to. I'm going to play a broken record because we have a broken economy. What are we going to do we have an old economy paradigm where you have, the brass industry, aerospace, and armaments that are clearly have gone for decades. And what's going to replace that? What's going to replace that? And I have a little song I just want to sing. And it is, where have all the good jobs gone? Long time passing. Where have all the good jobs gone? Long time ago. So you know, that's basically, you know, I think the theme song for the for this new generation, I think, the lost generation.
You know, Peter, I was going to say you're moving on to Vegas, but both Christine and Danny hit X. So you're
yes. If we do this like The Voice at some point.
Connecticut's Got Talent.
Connecticut's Got Talent. Peter, thank you very much for the...
Is this Peter Yarrow?
For the song and everything else. He's talking about where have all the good jobs gone. Isn't that part of it, Dan?
They've all gone to the hedge funds. Unfortunately, they're too good a job because there's too high a percentage of the state and national income that's accruing to what used to be considered a valuable service in the economy, which is creating liquidity through movement of money. And that's gone amok. 40% to 50% of all corporate profits for most of last year were in the financial sector. And that's a sign of an unhealthy accrual.
And that's not Connecticut's fault.
That's Connecticut's to our benefit.
And that's to our benefit. But because that's to our benefit, I mean, look, we don't make as many things here. We still have quite a bit of manufacturing in the state, but as Peter says, not as much as we used to. The reliance on the hedge fund industry, the reliance on financial services post 2008, Dan, and we're going to talk in just a moment about whether or not people at the state capitol want to raise taxes on the wealthiest people in the state, whether or not we want to find new ways of getting money out of hedge fund managers. Well, I mean, if that's where all the money is, isn't that where we're going to get the money from?
Yes, and if you want to get money out of hedge fund managers, don't tax them. That's as simple as that. This should be, this, I don't know if we're getting, are we getting into this tax issue?
Sure, let's talk about it. Let's do it.
The tax issue is that
nationally. Or else Peter will sing again.
No.
I'm just kidding.
The tax issue is that nationally, the of course, the highest income rate is 39.2 or 3%. And hedge funds, because of the way they're taxed at a 20% rate nationally. This has nothing whatsoever to do with state taxation. The proposal that, that Christine covered in great detail yesterday and has a great story about is to take the difference that they would have paid in the national tax, in the federal income tax, and take it for ourselves in Connecticut, right? This is equivalent to going to U-Haul and buying boxes and shaping up the boxes and taking them to the hedge funds, to Bridgewater and all the rest, Point 72, and saying, here, take these boxes and put your stuff in it and get out now. Because this is a national policy, and it's absolutely imperative that, as Donald Trump campaigned, it's called the carried interest exemption. It would be tremendous to get rid of it. It serves no purpose whatsoever in society. It used to. But it cannot be done state by state or region by region, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New York.
Right. So there is a trigger in the legislation that says Connecticut won't do this unless, you know, New York, Massachusetts, and what was the other one? New Jersey?
New Jersey,
you know, also gets rid of this. But you can't do – Dan's right. You can't do tax policy on a regional or a state-by-state basis when the problem is a national problem. At the same time, the hedge fund association's like, you know, look, all we need is our laptop and we can go move ourselves to Florida.
Yeah.
And that's exactly where they were apparently when news of this legislation hit the news, I guess.
Colin, go ahead.
Well, just I mean,
go ahead.
There's been an 11% drop in financial services since 2007.
I mean, so, Christine said the most important thing, which is this is the most mobile class of business people in America. So, I mean, you know, if somebody says, oh, well, if you tax my candy store some more, I'm going to move. Well, they're going to have some problems moving. You know, these people will not have problems moving or relocating or at least creating residence for the requisite amount of time so that they can claim they live, you know, in some other place with lower taxes. You just don't want to really mess with these people. But just to sort of circle back and kind of include everything that we've talked about, to me, one of the problems that I always have, or one of the questions I always have about the state of Connecticut and the Malloy administration to a certain degree, it's really true with transportation, but I worry that it might be true with stuff like this, is if you have every policy, you have no policy. You know, so you asked, where are all the jobs going to come from? Well, I mean, I think the answer is, well, I don't know, we're trying like a lot of things. You know, and that's fine, although I think you have to identify priorities. We spent a lot of money, as you suggested early on Jackson Labs. You know, I mean, I'm not saying go all in on biosciences, but prioritize some stuff and say, this is really where we think growth is going to come. This is how we think we can make growth happen. You know, this is the kind of infrastructure that they need. You know, maybe going to that, the so-called gig economy is actually a real, you know, good investment as opposed to some of the other stuff we're talking about. But develop priorities and stick to them, I think, is better than just, you know, trying everything.
I feel like they have had, you know, maybe some success as far as manufacturing is concerned. You know, they were able to get the community colleges to buy into this, and they set up, you know, manufacturing apprentice programs and training programs. And so they're beginning to provide jobs there. And Connecticut is focused on the high precision manufacturing, you know, but at the same time, as far as manufacturing is concerned, the state is still bailing out companies like Colt. They just gave $10 million to Colt to make sure they stay in the state.
Yeah, and that couldn't have necessarily felt very good to Governor Malloy, who has spent most of the last couple of years since the Sandy Hook shootings not really talking with people in the firearms industry. You know, that's...
Well, I would say that, you know, the state employees were probably more upset about it because it's the state employee pension fund that bailed out Colt from its first bankruptcy, or was it its second?
But is the state employee pension fund better off if Colt picks up and leaves? Because they really were considering leaving.
Right.
This is not a case of you know, we both covered that whole issue in 2013. This is not a case of an idle threat. I thought it was amazing that it was at a China moment when, you know, Malloy goes to Colts on New Park Avenue and gives them $10 million to stay, and they're adding 100 jobs to boot. I think that's pretty good.
I looked at it, and I thought that was striking to me. Let's just put it that way. Because, again, he had fairly famously said he wasn't even really talking with the firearms manufacturers in the state about some of the legislation that was coming out post-Sandy Hook, which is something that a lot of people in the firearms industry were concerned about. But before we move too far away from taxes, I just want to say there's other things that are on the table. what are we going to do to fill the gigantic budget hole, Dan? Everyone knows some sort of taxes are going to go up. So we're not going to tax the richest of the rich because they'll pack up their U-Hauls or whatever and leave. Are we all going to take it out in sales taxes?
It's hard for me to imagine this happening without an increase in sales taxes. Half-point increase generates $300 million. Plugging 10% of the exemptions, the things that aren't taxed out there, like funeral services, I know I'm going to get, you know, that's just naming one here, is another $300 million. It's hard to imagine happening without that, especially considering that having 138 out of 169 towns lose money is impossible to imagine. And, of course, there is the sugary drinks tax.
Yeah. How much are you going to make off the sugary drinks?
$85 million is the estimate. Yeah. So it's a penny per ounce. So the public hearing on that was yesterday. But I think broadening the sales tax base and eliminating some of the exemptions, they're going to have to go there. They have to do it. Otherwise, they're going to have to consider another income tax increase on the wealthy.
What they said. We're short on time.
I just want to point out that the concern with the sugary tax is people who drink soda might leave the state, and they are a very mobile group.
Right.
I just want to get to Kent in West Hartford. Hey, Kent, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I think the topic that you guys are talking about is very interesting and one that really resonates with me a lot. I think the three questions I often ask myself as a resident here in Connecticut is, one, why would people want to live here in Connecticut? Two, why would people want to work here in Connecticut? And three, why would companies want to move jobs here? And I think those are three fundamental questions that I think the administration needs to ask. And then really look across the spectrum to say, okay, short-term and long-term, what is the state of Connecticut doing to attract people in those three spaces?
Kent, I got to ask you a question, though. Are you a millennial by any chance?
I am, yeah.
Why do you live here?
I live here primarily because my family is here, and two, Connecticut still has some of the best schools in the country. So that's still a fact. And I think that's one of the things that still attracts a lot of people here, particularly in the Fairfield County area. But I would say overall, people are definitely moving out, and largely because of those three spaces that I talked about. If you look at GE, for example, GE moved to Boston from Fairfield because, you know, Boston provides really, really great opportunities for people to work and live in a space that offers a lot of amenities. When you look at restaurants,
yeah. And the other quick thing is, and Danny Hart was just, you know, wanting me to ask you about this. I mean, you're close to New York and Boston here, right? You can get into the city, you can get up to Boston. I mean, Connecticut's pretty well located for that sort of thing too, isn't it?
Right. It is. Locationally, it's very convenient to move to go to Boston or New York if someone wanting to do that. But again, not everyone would like to travel that far to enjoy the amenities of the space that they live in. So I think, you know, it behooves the administration, you know, the administration to really look into some of these things and to consider how long-term we can make the state a little bit more attractive, particularly.
Absolutely. And Ken, I really take your point, and I got to go just because I got to get up against the break, but I really thank you for the phone call. I had to ask about two other things that they're considering up at the state capitol. One has to do with bears, and one has to do with bailouts, bailing out Millstone, actually, the nuclear power plant that powers about half the state, Dan.
It's the largest generation plant in New England. We don't get all of their power, so it would, if we got all the power, it would power about half the state. Millstone, because I'm going to see if I can do this in 30 seconds or less, because natural gas prices have dropped and because plants have generally become more efficient and the old oil-powered SUTY 6 plants have retired. Therefore, the wholesale price of electricity, that is the price that somebody pays generation plants, has gone down because Millstone's prices are constant over time. They don't change based on oil prices and fuel prices. Their profits have gone down. They are now going to the state saying, hold an auction so that we can sell our power directly to Eversource and United Illuminating. That gives them a break. 10 years ago when they were printing money because the opposite was true, Dick Blumenthal, then Attorney General, said, we've got to do something. Millstone said, let the free market prevail. My point today, let the free market prevail. No break for Millstone.
I'll just say quickly, Dan, part of the reason, though, they're faced with this challenge is because natural gas prices, as you say, are low. The state, quite famously, not too many years ago, doubled down on gas infrastructure. They wanted to make a big bet on natural gas, cheap gas coming from places like Pennsylvania and Oklahoma or wherever, and that's a big part of it. So we're potentially driving a nuclear power generator out of the region, in part because we've decided to drive down the cost of natural gas so low that it's not competitive.
Yeah, the Millstone plant is somewhat less mobile than, say, Bridgewater, for example, the hedge fund. They are implying a threat that they would close, and this same company, Dominion, did close a plant for economic reasons in Wisconsin. New York State, Massachusetts have all seen plants closing before their licenses end. So it's not something we should scoff at, but there's a long process, and the region has an opportunity to offer money to Millstone 4 years ahead of a closing if it gives that warning, which it has not.
To be fair, they have a very nice candy store in the lobby, which might leave. Right. I want to ask you, actually, Christine, about are we going to have a bear hunt in Connecticut?
A bear hunt? No, I don't think that, you know. This legislation proposed proposed back in 2011, that there would be a bear hunt lottery to reduce the number of black bears in the state. I don't think
the hunters would be in the lottery, not the bears. Right. Oh, you picked the wrong number, bear. Start running.
It's sort of like Keno for bears. Yeah.
I don't think that we're going to see this anytime soon.
Okay. Even though this is something that the DEP wants, right?
There's a lot of damn bears around, too.
Has there been an attack?
There hasn't been an attack. There was that weird encounter on that trail. Yeah, was it in Farmington?
Burlington?
Was it a mugging?
But some of you may remember, on Halloween night, I live half a mile from the executive residence, or whatever it's called, and there were bears in my yard, and they were running towards the executive residence where Governor Millett gives out candy on Halloween. I was thinking, gee, bears running towards little people with bags of food in their hands. What could go wrong here? I mean, I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I called the police immediately, and they go, we'll tell animal control. I said, no, don't just tell animal control. This is an emergency.
All right, so Colin wants a big bear hunt in the state. We got to move on. Maybe when we come back, we got to talk a lot about a lot of other things that happened in the news this week with Colin McEnroe, Christine Stewart of CTNewsJunkie.com, Dan Haar of the Hartford Current. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Christine Stewart, the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, and Dan Haar of The Hartford Current. Just want to say that the Yard Goats open up finally in Hartford. Their very first home game is tomorrow. WNPR will be there. Jeff Cohen is hosting a series of Facebook Live videos from the game. Also, check out a brand new podcast from Colin McEnroe Show producer Jonathan McNichol called The Second First Season. It's all about the Yard Goats' first season at home. They actually did a soft launch last night, Danny, and they turned on all the lights, and they had a couple college teams play. The scoreboard didn't work for a while, and what we heard is the power actually went out a little early, but it was because it was on a timer. They actually hadn't set the timer right, and all the lights went out.
I have a light on a timer in my living room, right, and it's set to go off at 1 a.m., and I can be sitting there at 1 a.m., and it goes off, and I just say, okay, well, that means it's time for me to go to sleep. So maybe it's some kind of a signal.
You have a light. Oh, this light goes off at 1 a.m.
off. It's okay. So that tells me I don't change it, and I can't get up and turn it back on because that would violate the principle of letting things happen just the way they happen.
To all you millennials, this is a baby boomer problem that we're talking about here.
Was there a delay in the game then?
I think there was a 15-minute delay.
Yes. And I think they're figuring out the scoreboard scoreboard problem. Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, Christine, are you excited? I mean, now that all this turmoil has passed, there's an actual functioning baseball stadium in downtown Hartford. Are you going to go there?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, I'm excited. Minor league baseball, I was a huge fan, growing up. I grew up near a minor league baseball stadium, and it's a great pastime. It's great for kids. It's accessible. I'm going to go.
Yeah. Colin, how about you? Are you excited about it now that it's opening?
I think I am somewhat excited about it. I should say that the Wall Street Journal, which is determined to pick on Connecticut and Hartford as much as possible, also has a Yard Goats piece that ran this week that I think is not entirely, because it's all subscription protected, I kind of had to take some guesses about what it seemed to be saying. But anyway, the one thing I'll say is this. Well, first of all, poor Jonathan McNichol, because he now, like, I'm right next to him in the newsroom, and I have a million opinions about baseball, all of which I now am sharing with Jonathan for his podcast. But one thing I will say about this is that we will have to learn, if you're not familiar with minor league baseball, you have to have a different relationship with minor league baseball, right? I mean, baseball, I think one of the reasons we love it so much is because it can really break our hearts, and it can also supply us with a concomitant amount of euphoria on the right occasions. But there's it's such an incredibly heartbreaking game when you really love a team a certain way and are very attached to certain kinds of outcomes. Now, with a double-A team, it's a little bit different, and Bull Durham, in many ways, the movie, was sort of about all the ways that you have to find a different way to relate to a double-A baseball team. Because if you really love one of the players, the best thing that can happen to that player is to leave.
That's right.
Which is like not how I feel about, say, Xander Bogaerts or something, I wish he would leave. But it's going to be different, but I think it's going to be fun in lots of other ways. And it can't help but be good for Hartford. And we already spent the money. It was crazy money. I'm not getting it back, so make it work.
Are you excited about Dan?
Very. And I think the point is that for the area, there needs to now be, starting Thursday, starting now really, a separation. The issues of development and the bollocksing and the lawsuits between CenterPlan and the city and the team, all that development stuff exists as one separate thing. And the games and baseball and going out to the ballpark and having an $8 beer. No, it's actually lower price than that. Having a beer and Bears barbecue and whoever Moose LaLouche is going to be this year and Susan Sarandon and all that stuff is another. And there's, even if you're an opponent of what happened, there's no reason not to say, let's celebrate baseball in Hartford.
We had so much to talk about today, and we're running low on time. So I'm just going to go to this thing, mostly just because I really want Christine Stewart's take on this. We have heard for years your travel adventures as you try to get back home to the Midwest over the holidays. Of course, we've all now seen the video of a man getting forcibly dragged off an overbooked United Airlines flight. Personally, my take in this is that I am going to be on the first ever flight on Spirit Airlines out of Bradley to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina later on this month. Spirit, of course, famously is one of these ultra low-budget carriers in which you have to pay for everything, I think including oxygen, to actually be on the plane. I don't even have a seat. I can take on a little tiny bag. So I'm very fascinated by the airline industry right now. What did you take out of this story, Christine, as a veteran of bad travel experiences?
Yeah, I don't know who did it, but somebody did this great diagram of a plane, and in the back, pretty much all of the coach section, it just said Fight Club. So you just have to, claw your way to apparently the best seat and hope that there's not a high priority passenger who's going to come in and wrestle it from you and take it from you and.
Are you the sort of flyer who would say, you know what? No, never. I'm never flying. It doesn't matter how cheap it is. If I got to get home, I'm flying something other than United.
Yeah, at this point, probably. I don't see any reason to fly United at all. I mean, we were talking about the cap on the vouchers. Apparently, they had a $1,300,
$1,350
cap.
And that's not just them, though.
They only went up to $800, and people still weren't taking it. So,
and people still, basically, Danny, they were saying, we'd like you to get off the plane. We can offer you up to this amount. They didn't go high enough. I mean, you write about economics, so you think this is an economics problem.
Economists call this an economic failure. That is, when something that's supposed
to
happen,
an economic failure.
When something that is supposed to happen according to the theory of economics simply doesn't happen, either because of the randomness of events or because of some other distortion, that they call an economic failure. That 130 people all uniformly refused an $800 voucher plus potential hotel plus the flight out the next day is an economic failure. It's a fluke. It will happen never again. To say I'm not going to fly United Airlines again is to miss the point that all of us as humans have this unbelievably beautiful capacity to keep forgetting how to do things right. And that's what happened at United, and we know how to do things right, and we just don't do it.
Well, yeah, but let's sort of take a look at United's public relations failure, because it wasn't just a failure there on the plane, the kind of failure that you're talking
That's
about.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, this is incredible. I mean, their inability to understand what was happening. These days, there's no such thing as a news cycle anymore. News cycles are over, all right? Your problems start the minute Twitter finds out about it, and they start crapping on you and making fun of you and doing Fight Club jokes about you. And then the next deadline you have to hit is when they start taping late-night comedy shows, because you really don't want Jimmy Kimmel going all out on you. So there wasn't that much that United could have done. The video was the video. They had that problem. But they doubled down on their kind of anti-customer position, which, from what I can tell from other anecdotal stuff that's coming out right now, is not uncommon for them. And so that's, to me, the real failure, is to not understand the situation you were in. They should have said within 2 hours of this video leaking out, you know what? Dr. Dow can go anywhere. We'll let him fly the jet. Whatever. He can go anywhere he wants for free for the rest of his life. We're really, really sorry.
Yeah, there's a whole other question we won't get to about everyone digging into Dr. Dow's backstory and then publishing some not-so-friendly details of that backstory. It's a fascinating conversation that we'll have to leave there with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you.
Thanks to Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you.
And thanks to Dan Haar of The Hartford Current. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
We want to thank Kyone Wolf, our technical producer. Welcome back, Kyone. It's very good to have you. Heather Brandon is our digital editor, and the executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us in The Wheelhouse.